for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, and this is the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition podcast. Every day except Thursday, this podcast brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column, and on Thursdays we do something different. And it varies from week to week. In this particular week, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring you the audio track from a talk that I gave last Tuesday, as a matter of fact, at Willamette University. So the political season is getting underway, and of course, as usual, it's the whole game theory thing. We get to pick the lesser of two evils, or at least the lesser of two mediocrities. So I thought when I was preparing my talks for Willamette University that maybe it would be a good to have a little reminder that, we've been through some crappy times before. So that was the subject of my talk, and I talked about politics in the 1890s, and it's about a 45-minute talk. You'll have to excuse me because I'm fairly new at public speaking. There are an awful lot of ums and uhs going on at the early parts of it. Just, hang on about 5 minutes into it. You'll hear me start to relax a little bit and talk more like a normal human. I also have to apologize for the sound quality of what I'm doing right now and what I've been doing for the past couple of days. I've been having some technical difficulties that I'm trying to solve, and it's resulted in some pretty spotty sound quality. Yesterday's podcast sounded like I was recording it from the bottom of a plastic garbage can. Today's sounds like a railroad yard, doesn't it? Okay, so if you are still signed on, sit back and relax for about the next 45 minutes and enjoy the talk that I gave at Willamette University on the subject of politics in 1890s Portland. Here we go.
Generally, because of what time of year it is right now, I want to talk about politics, 1890s style. See, in a couple months here, our long national nightmare will be over, or depending on who you want to win the election, perhaps it will have just begun. I don't know. In any case, in case you're getting a bit tired of it all, I thought today would be a good day to remind everybody that, as the Bare Naked Ladies song puts it, it's all been done before, except that not too long ago it was done more brazenly with more impressive-looking stacks of cash and much, much more fabulous-looking mustaches. So, dirty politics, both here in Salem and in Portland in the 19th century. Now, some of these stories, I've got three of them for you that I want to lay on you today, and some of them are in my book and some of them are not. Remember, the book's about Portland, and a lot of people up there think that that's where all the good stories are, and everybody down here knows that's not quite true. there's plenty of naughty stuff in Salem's past as well. Today I'm going to tell you some stories relating to Salem, stories that have to do with wickedness and sin and all those other fun things. And I'm going to start off with a story related to the first Oregon legislature in 1859, the year Oregon became a state. We had our first state legislature, as opposed to the territorial legislature, which was before that, which got us off to a rollicking start with the unwitting help of the last guy that you would ever expect to help out with that, a Baptist circuit rider from Tennessee, who was hired as the first chaplain of the legislature. This resulted in a number of firsts for the legislature, including the first political fundraiser, the first little bit of funds skimmed off of the fundraiser, and the first legislative den of iniquity, but not the last. Then I'm going to talk a little bit, if I have time, about the nuttiest state governor in the history of the universe. The one who once told the President of the United States to mind his own business. The one, if any of you guys are law school students, you'll recognize his name immediately. It's Sylvester Penoyer, as in Penoyer versus Neff. Finally, I'm going to tell you the story of the 40-day drunken party, which was thrown in 1896 with the purpose of stopping Senator John Mitchell from being sent back to Washington, D.C. Before I do that, though, I wanted to say a couple of things real quick, because this is Willamette University, and it's a pretty important place to me because I am kind of, if you scratch me down deep, I'm a Herbert Hoover scholar. That was the focus of my studies in graduate school. And this is totally off topic, but Willamette University had a key role in stopping the worst famine in the history of the world, which never happened because somebody from Willamette University stopped it. hundreds of millions of people were supposed to be going to starve to death after World War I, during which nobody bothered to plant anything. And they didn't because this kid from Salem grew up to become the one guy that could marshal the resources of the whole world and the grain belt in the U.S. to stop the famine. And that kid took night classes here at Willamette while he was working at his uncle's real estate business. I'm going to go on microphone control. It really sucks. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, when he got a chance to go to Stanford and get his degree, he did it. He would not have probably qualified for admission to Stanford without the education he got here. Stanford led to him becoming a mining engineer, and that led to him having the not only the ability, but the money, he's going to need the money, to put together something called the Commission for Relief in Belgium, which stopped the entire nation of Belgium from starving to death while the United Kingdom and the Imperial Germany were arguing over whose responsibility it was to feed them. The CRB, the Commission for Relief in Belgium, led to the American Relief Agency, which was the major source of calories for 230 million people in defeated Austria and Germany for several years after the war, plus a bunch in Soviet Russia, did it again after World War II. This one kid who started out taking night classes at this university ended up saving more people from starving to death than Adolf Hitler, Mao Zedong, and Joseph Stalin killed, all put together. He did, though, then make a major error. He got himself elected president, and he was a disaster as a president, and that's chiefly what he's remembered for today. Of course, I'm talking about Herbert Hoover. And the story of the pre-political activism life of Herbert Hoover is just a fascinating one. And nobody looks at it because, you know, he's this sort of like rubber-necked president that was driving the bus during the Great Depression. So I find that fascinating, and I'm really excited to share that with you guys because this place was key in that story. That's another story, though. It's probably going to be my next book project. But I want to start talking about the first state legislature, which is what you guys came to hear about. Also, I'm going to talk about the first state legislative session, the first official state chaplain, the first prayer offered up from the legislative floor, the first insult hurled from the floor, all in the same 7 seconds, the first act of deficit spending, the first rigged political fundraiser, and the first legislative den of iniquity, all of which centered around the same story about the same guy. And this story is not in my book because it's a Salem story. It's about Salem in 1859, and so here's what happened. The legislators in the first state house and the state senate were keenly aware of the historic nature of what they were trying to do. And they decided they needed some spiritual guidance, or probably more accurately, they decided they needed the appearance of some spiritual guidance. So, a chaplain of the legislature was needed. Somebody who would start off each day by offering up a little prayer for divine guidance, be around to lend the legislature an air of reverence and respectability, and, you know, that probably mostly were not entirely sincere about this, but everybody knew that it was good PR, so they looked around for a suitable preacher. Well, whether they ended up with a suitable preacher or not, well, let's just go with not. They ended up with Uncle Joab Powell. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Uncle Joab. He was the most famous preacher in Oregon at the time, which is why they thought of him right away. He was a Baptist circuit rider, which is an itinerant preacher with a regular route. He'd go from town to town giving sermons and doing those big tent revival things and stuff like that, saving souls, dunking people in the river. He was a powerfully built man, seemed to have no neck. His voice was legendary. It roared and bellowed and pleaded for lost souls and stuff like that. He was illiterate, but his wife read the Bible to the family and he memorized the verses, and sometimes he didn't remember them quite correctly, so that would add a little extra zest to his services, as he called them, because he was from Tennessee, he had the accent. He lived with a huge family at the Forks of the San Yam out by Sayo. And his church that he founded is still there. It's in a new building, but it's called the Providence Community Church. The key thing that I want you guys to understand about Uncle Joab, he was completely unsubtle, unsophisticated, probably not especially clever, but at the same time, he was just chock full of that kind of combination of ferocious passion and brotherly love that the circuit riders were famous for. You can imagine what's going to happen when somebody like that gets mixed up with a bunch of politicians. So, with eyes for Uncle Joab's fame, the legislators voted to offer him $30 to come and be the chaplain of the legislature. And Uncle Joab accepted that gig immediately, hustled to Salem as fast as he could go, and along comes the first day of the Oregon State Legislature. The gavel comes down. Uncle Joab is invited to get things started with a little prayer. And I always have to imagine these guys were kind of scrunching around in their chairs trying to get comfortable, because Uncle Joab was known for going on and on and on. He would go on for hours when the Spirit moved him. And it was a historic occasion, so the Spirit could be expected to move him today. So surely the legislators expected 20 minutes, maybe? They got 20 seconds, if they even got that. They actually probably got quite a bit less than that. Uncle Joab stood up and went,
"Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do."
And he sat back down.
Those words are immortalized on the Capitol ball in a stone.
Oh, nice.
That's wonderful. I'm going to go take a picture of that to put it with my with the column on it. So I have to say, as the opening prayer at the dawn of Oregon statehood, that's just and of course the first insult hurled from the state from the floor, all before the legislative session was a minute old. And these would not be the only firsts that we'd get from Uncle Joab. On the following weeks, some irreconcilable differences started appearing. The legislature obviously was focused on governance and material stuff and things like that. And of course, Uncle Joab was focused on other things. And he, I'm afraid, made rather a pest of himself. Long, pointed prayers, probably also occasionally objecting to legislative action on moral grounds. Finally, the legislators decided it had all been a horrible mistake, and they needed to cashier him. And Uncle Joab, when they talked to him, was gracious and affable and said, "No problem, I'll go back to my family. Just give me my $30 and I'll leave." Well, no, this was a problem. Because, see, that $30 was actually the state's first ever act of deficit spending. They didn't actually have the $30 yet. So what were they going to do now? It doesn't seem to have occurred to them that they could pass a kitty around, you know, and pay for it out of their personal fortunes. They weren't going to do that. Luckily, though, one of the senators came up with a plan. It was a plan for another Oregon political first, which is the political fundraiser. They printed up a nice big stack of flyers advertising a grand entertainment starring none other than Uncle Joab Powell. They hoped to clear, I don't know, about $30 at the door. However, when the day came, it became really clear that the lawmakers had underestimated Salem's thirst for grand entertainment. Virtually the entire town turned out. The house was packed. Gate receipts were in the hundreds of dollars. And this is back when 50 cents a day was a pretty good wage. I said, 50 cents? Yeah, I guess it would be 50 cents a day. Sailors were making $30 a month. Well, some of the legislators were starting to get nervous. And maybe they were remembering this 20-second prayer with which Uncle Joab had opened the legislature on the first day. I mean, what's going to happen if he pulls a stunt like that again with the entire town of Salem sitting there with their jaws hanging open? Was it possible for the state legislature to get run out of its own capital city on a rail covered with tar and feathers? Probably not, but it must have crossed someone's mind. Luckily, though, Senator Victor Trevitt had a plan. He rounded up a gaggle of street urchins and gave each one of them a pocket full of the coins that they'd taken in at the gate. And the boys were given strict instructions to, if Uncle Joab sounded like he was winding down, shower him with money and shout, "Encore! Encore!" Well, I haven't been able to learn whether this was necessary or not. But in any case, Uncle Joab put in a fine performance, was packed off the next day to his farm with his $30, along with probably some tips from courtesy of the little boys in the front row. And this was probably just as well, because the Reverend Uncle Joab would not have wanted to be around to see what the legislature had in mind for the rest of the money his performance had provided them with. They set up a discreet little dive bar in an unused committee room and spent the money stocking it with liquor. So, a nice little legislative den of iniquity, yet another Oregon first. Definitely not the last, though, as you'll find out when we get to talking about the holdup session. That's Uncle Joab. The election of 1896 was the holdup session, and that's when things are going to get kind of a little bit more interesting, cementing Oregon's legislative reputation for kind of political craftiness and chicanery, even by Gilded Age and Tammany Hall standards. The state legislature by then already had acquired a tolerably terrible reputation, but this really kind of put the cherry on it. Oswald West later recalled that when lawmakers came to town and for the legislative session, he would be working at a local bank, where he was a bank clerk, found himself suddenly handling these huge sums of money that were being shipped out to the money people up in Portland and flowing back down here too, so that the legislators could be properly bought and paid for, which was done with a stunning degree of openness. There was also a troop of prostitutes that would always convene when the legislature came together. Some of these girls actually got put on the payroll. This, according to a master's thesis from a guy, Basil, I think is his last name, in 1927, which was relatively soon after the time that we're talking about here. So, the thing is, you've heard, obviously, the term Wild West, and the thing to remember is that Oregon at this time was both wilder and westerner, and it went all the way to the top. So before I get into the legislature, I want to take a few minutes to talk about the nuttiest state governor in the history of the universe, who some of you have surely already heard this one, too. We've got some real weirdos running for office this year, but none of them can touch the governor that ruled Oregon with an iron fist from, 1887 to 1895. His name, of course, was Sylvester Penoyer, the Penoyer versus Neff Penoyer. And his story, by the way, the Penoyer story is in the book. It's at the end of chapter 7. And I could read it to you, but it's kind of short in there, and I want to kind of expand it a little bit further because I had to stuff this book into 40,000 words, and I think I ended up with 40,116, and I got, kind of growled at a little bit. There's some good stuff that got left out of it, including the story of the temperance riots in Portland in 1874. But I posted that on the website if anybody wants to go check it out. So Sylvester Penoyer was a Harvard man. Back when being a Harvard man meant something that is other than brilliant. Because Harvard at that time in the 1800s was a not too demanding college where rich guys could send their sons without really worrying about them washing out. Not that that never happened. Some fairly important people did wash out, including Jonathan Bourne Jr., whom we will get to know better in a bit. He got kicked out of Harvard. But it wasn't because he couldn't hack it. It was because he hired a burglar to break in and change his transcript grades. Kind of, maybe he was the first high school computer hacker, I don't know. But, so that didn't work for him. The burglar got caught, so did Jonathan. That was the end of that. That's why he ended up, that may be why he ended up in Oregon. Well, we'll get to that in a little bit. Sylvester graduated, though. And he came out to Portland to teach in one of the very early schools here. Opportunities for young, well-connected, upper-class guys in Portland were pretty good in the 1850s. They were terrible for everybody else. But Sylvester, having the magic combination of ethnicity and gender and family background, got in on the ground floor of lumber processing. And by the mid-1880s, he was worth a giant pile. He was also nuts. And he wasn't one of those lovable nuts either. He wasn't like, Falstaff in Shakespeare or one of those guys that's, kind of like the lovable rogue type. No, not this dude. Penoyer was an early member of the Populist Party and represented a lot of what was really kind of bad about the Populist Party. For starters, he was a fierce and unapologetic racist. It's 30 years after the Civil War, and he still supported a return to slavery. Not just saying it was a good idea, but he supported a return to it. He hated the Chinese and wanted them driven out of town. However, if you were a working stiff of Northern European descent, he was your best friend. At one point when he was governor, actually a railroad company in Albany started yelling for him to call out the National Guard to because its workers were threatening to riot because they hadn't gotten paid. And Penoyer told the railroad people that he'd call out the guard if the workers got paid and decided to riot anyway, but that it wasn't appropriate for the state to act, you know, as in providing enforcement goons for a mass robbery scheme, which, you know, credit where credit is due, that was the right call. But I guess it just kind of goes to show that even a blind pig can find a truffle once in a while. You will have gathered that I'm not a big Penoyer fan, but it is an interesting story to kind of watch from afar. He rose to prominence in state politics, basically by hijacking a political rally that a mayor candidate up in Portland was doing and turning it into this wild, slogan-chanting, brick-throwing, anti-Chinese riot. And it went on for days. See, the Chinese Exclusion Act had just gone in, and, well, it had gone in a couple of years before, basically slamming the door on further Chinese immigration into the U.S. The railroads were built, so we didn't need the cheap labor, so, you know, and then there was this little recession, and people started wanting the Chinese to leave. And Penoyer was leading these sort of xenophobia-crazed Portlanders around for several days of fairly scary demonstrations before finally kind of calming them down by urging them to, quote, seek relief at the ballot. Guess whose name was at the top of the ballot? That's how he became governor. So he rode this wave of anti-Chinese xenophobia into the governorship, and as governor, he seemed to just want to go out of his way to get noticed. Another future governor, T.T. Geer, who I think was a Silverton boy. Anyway, he later wrote that Penoyer said and did things that, quote, were absurd in the extreme and created great merriment in the legislature and out of it. And no, they were not laughing with him. He was elected as a Democrat, soon switched sides and became a populist, which naturally put a little poison into his relationship with the state Democratic Party. When Grover Cleveland was elected president, late in his term of office, the Dems wanted to use the state's ceremonial cannon to fire a salute to his inauguration, and Penoyer wouldn't let them. Locked it up under armed guard, the Democrats had to actually forge a bill for blacksmith repair and get the sheriff to seize the cannon so they could use it to fire the salute. But feuding with presidents of the United States is what Penoyer became most well known for. He started things off right with President Benjamin Cleveland's predecessor, Benjamin Harrison. Grover Cleveland. Benjamin Harrison came to tour the state. Of course, he came up from California on the railroad. And, you know, typically you would expect a governor to meet the president at the border, you know, or at least at, you know, in Ashland, basically, kind of show him around, welcome to the state, etc. Nothing doing. Penoyer said, this is a quote, "I have no business to go pay homage to him. On the contrary, when he visits Oregon, he should pay his respects to me." Okay, so there was a little argument in the backstage about this. And finally, he relented a little and agreed to meet the president at the train station here in Salem, where in the drizzling rain, he kept the president's party waiting for about 10 minutes and finally showed up in just an outrageously showy carriage pulled by snow-white horses, you know, like some sort of sultan or something. But it was after Cleveland was actually elected, the Democrat guy, that Sylvester's most famous little bit of president baiting occurred. And this happened after the Chinese Exclusion Act was renewed for another 10 years. You may remember the Chinese Exclusion Act being a subject that was fairly near to Sylvester's heart. President Cleveland was worried about potential riots breaking out when the act was extended and the possibility of Chinese communities getting attacked. And this had kind of already happened in several West Coast cities. I mean, this wasn't you know, a ghost of a danger. This, Tacoma and Sacramento had both driven their Chinese communities out. And a lot of them had ended up in Portland, because although Portland wasn't exactly hospitable, they at least weren't coming after them with torches and pitchforks. So Cleveland sent this telegram out to the governors of Oregon, California, and Idaho, and the territorial governor of Washington, which wasn't a state yet, and it said, quote, "Apparently reliable reports indicate danger of violence to Chinese when Exclusion Act takes effect, and the president hopes you will employ all lawful means for their protection in your state here, Oregon, Washington, etc." Presumably he got a more civilized response from the other governors, but Sylvester Penoyer's reply was, "Washington, I will attend to my business. Let the president attend to his." Sylvester Penoyer, governor of Oregon. That one reverberated around the country for years. As far as I know, by the way, there were no problems in Oregon with the Exclusion Act. But then by the time, when this was going on, there was another fairly high-ranking government official happily helping some friends smuggle thousands of Chinese laborers along with tons and tons of opium into the port of Portland on steamships, you know, wholesale smuggling. And this is another story which you'll find in Chapter 8 of my book under the chapter is titled World's Dumbest Drug Smugglers. And I'm pretty sure that it's accurate. But it does suggest, how, you know, that notwithstanding Pinoyer's riot, that Oregonians had a slightly more mellow attitude toward the Chinese people than people did in other states. One of the last things that Pinoyer did was to earn himself a nickname. And I'll tell you how he did that. First, though, I have to ask, is anybody familiar with Bull Run Water up in Portland? Pretty good stuff, eh? Pinoyer did not think so. In fact, he saw no reason to spend a bunch of money getting water from some mountain gully miles away when the Willamette River brought billions of gallons of perfectly good water right into the middle of town every day. Of course, you have to take certain liberties with the meaning of the term perfectly good to take that position. You know, the old saying comes to mind, we all live downstream. Portland lives downstreamer than most places. And to put it bluntly, what you flush in Salem at that time was several days later being served with a splash of scotch in various restaurants in Portland. So yeah, this was kind of a problem. In any case, when the city of Portland came to the legislature with its hat in its hand, asking for bonding authority to build Bull Run, Pinoyer vetoed it. He said, the problem was that Bull Run water originated in glacier runoff, which meant that, this is a quote, this would cause goiter in the fair sex of Portland. Goiter, by the way, is a swelling of the thyroid gland in the neck, and it's usually a thyroid an iodine deficiency, and iodine is sometimes present in industrial pollution, so he may have actually had a point with that. But by vetoing Bull Run, he was putting the fair sex of Portland at risk for, rather than goiter, maybe cholera or typhoid fever. And yes, people were actually dying of these things, especially typhoid. Judge Matthew Deedy was furious at this. He put in a lot of work on the Bull Run plan and was acutely aware that people were dying from the water supply in Portland. And the legislature came within one vote of overriding his veto, but that didn't make the bill any less dead, and it didn't make Deedy any less mad. And Deedy vented in his journal, and possibly outside of it as well, that he ought to be named Silpester Annoyer, which is kind of, it sort of stuck. The ironic part, though, after leaving Salem, Pinoyer was elected mayor of Portland, and in that capacity, he was the guy who was presiding over the ceremony when Bull Run was inaugurated. Yes, they had found another way to do it, and they had gotten it done. And so there he is, and he has to take the first sip. And game to the last, but still very grumpy about it, he picks up the goblet, takes a sip, swishes it around in his mouth, you know, like a wine taster would or something, and sets the goblet down with a sour face, and he says, "No flavor, no body. Give me the old Willamette." Which may be as close as he was going to come to admitting that he was wrong about Bull Run Reservoir, given how desirable flavor and body are in municipal drinking water. So I've got one more that I want to tell you about Portland politics, and it's another one that played out mostly here in Salem. And this one is in the book, too. It's chapter 9, that titled fairly uninspiredly, Wicked Politics. It's the story of the hold-up session. It was one of my very favorite stories from the 1890s, and it stars my all-time favorite Oregon politician. That would be this guy. The little fellow hiding behind the enormous mustache. This is Jonathan Bourne Jr., and I mentioned him a little while ago. This is the guy that got kicked out of Harvard for hiring a burglar to change his grades. He was super rich and a wild, wild kid. He was the only son of one of the richest men in New Bedford, Massachusetts, which at the time was the whaling capital of the world. And yeah, his family was in whaling and also had a cotton mill. And I'm still very curious as to why he had to leave New England. I mean, it's inconvenient getting kicked out of Harvard for criminal activity. But that's nothing that, you know, a liberal application of cash wouldn't have taken care of. And he was the only son of Jonathan Bourne Sr., who would have been, I'm sure, happy to have applied that application of cash. And then he could have maybe gone to Princeton or something, who knows. There was something, though, that he had done, and I have no idea what it was, something that had made not only New Bedford but all of New England too hot for him. Because he slunk out of town, he dropped out of college and slunk out of town on a whaling ship with less than a year to go before he'd get his degree. And after knocking around the world for a while, he ended up shipwrecked off of Formosa, and on the way back, he came into Portland. Once here, he settled in fast. Jonathan made friends with some key people in the sort of gritty, dangerous, but fast-living waterfront part of town called the North End, and it's part of Old Town today. But he basically ended up offering political cover for folks with illegal businesses there, opium dens and gambling parlors and brothels and Shanghai boarding houses and stuff like that, in exchange, of course, for generous contributions of both cash and votes. The votes are especially interesting as far as the North End goes. One of his most mutually beneficial associations was with the Shanghai artist up there called Larry Sullivan, who ran a boarding house that was always full of rootless sailors and had associations with other boarding houses and people that he knew that were also equally ruthless, or not ruthless, but rootless. And on election day, he would march them all over town and they'd vote their heads off. They just stuffed ballot boxes because they didn't have ID, right? You know, you just go to one ballot box and vote, go to another one and vote, all over town. And Larry was spiffing them probably a drink or two for every time they did that. And Larry was banking $2 to $5 every time one of them did that. So he was doing quite well. One time he actually enfranchised the entire crew of a Dutch windjammer, none of whom could actually speak English, but they could sure all vote for whoever Larry wanted. Lots of other marginally documented folks, if they were lucky enough to be in town for election day, they could make a little bit of extra money and lots of free drinks by joining this party too. Loggers and miners and steam schooner crews, all of them kind of concentrated in that rummy neighborhood down there, the North End, where Larry and others like him could find them. They'd fan out all over town. It was a pretty slick operation. It was a large part of the reason why Bourne ended up becoming a major VIP in Oregon politics. That, of course, and the fact that he was super rich and really good one-on-one. He was very charismatic. He wasn't good in a big group, which is why he only served one term in the Senate. But that's another story. Jonathan had always been a Republican, which did not mean the same thing then as it does now, obviously. But one thing was the same. The guys with money mostly were Republicans. And the problem was the conservative wing of the GOP was all for the gold standard, which means every dollar in circulation had to be backed with gold. And this was fine as long as the people in California and Eastern Oregon were digging up new supplies of gold all the time. But it got to be kind of a problem when they started to peter out. And the economy was starting to show the strain. And I'm just going to make a real fast detour into economics land. The problem with this whole thing is that if the gold standard is if your economy grows, right, it's growing by adding more stuff, more sacks of grain and more, I don't know, widgets, more things, but you have the same amount of money in circulation buying those widgets, so the money is increasing in value as if it were an investment. It's the opposite of inflation, it's deflation. Less money buying more stuff. Your stuff to money ratio is all screwed up. So when deflation is happening, suddenly it's a good investment to take your money out of your wallet and stuff it in your mattress because 2 years from now it's going to be worth a lot more. And that means that creates a sort of a debt spiral because more money disappears from circulation and it just gets worse and worse. And that's really oversimplified, but that's kind of the basic idea. So that's kind of starting to happen. And there's two ideas about how to deal with it. The conservative money people in the Republican Party wanted to stick with the gold standard no matter what. And then there were the free silver people who wanted to add silver to the mix and, you know, peg the currency to either gold or silver. That would add more money to the program and free up the economy again. And this was called bimetallism. And the reason all this is important is that in 1896, bimetallism was Jonathan Bourne's number one thing. It was his absolute priority. He didn't much care about the money supply, per se, because he had lots of that. But he owned a bunch of silver mines in eastern Oregon, see? And bimetallism was really good for the silver business. If the silver thing actually happened, he would make a real killing. So he and his fellow Republican cronies from the silver wing of the Republican Party, I guess you could say, were doing everything they could to get populist William Jennings Bryan elected president. And this was a big job. So Jonathan was pretty sure his local gangs of sailors and hobos were not going to be adequate to get it done. So in addition to them, he hired this notorious operator from California named Billy Smith, who agreed to bring a gang of repeaters up from California on election day and stuff every ballot box in town and then disappear into the southbound on a southbound train like a puff of smoke in the wind the following morning. And as part of his compensation for these services, Jonathan agreed to remove the wanted poster of Billy from the wall of the Portland Police Department, which was pretty easily done because he was a police commissioner at the time. The story of the police commission is in the book too. I can't remember the chapter name, but it's an interesting one. Basically, the legislature took over the Portland Police Department and installed this old crooked gambler named James Lapius as chief. So in the fireplace of the posh Arlington Club, according to the legend, I don't have this on solid authority, but that supposedly is where the wanted poster of Billy Smith was burned. Now, Jonathan was also running for a seat in the House. So when all these hired goons are stuffing Portland's ballot boxes full of bogus votes, his name was going to be on them too. He had this plan, see? He was going to get himself elected Speaker of the House, first rattle out of the box. He'd been a legislator in 1885, you know, some years earlier, but he was going to come back and he was going to take over, and this was how. First off, he was making the rounds in the legislature with a suitcase full of cash. The Southern Pacific Railway had given him $225,000 to use buying the support of legislators, so they'd vote to renominate John Mitchell to the U.S. Senate. Mitchell at the time was a good friend of Bourne's. He was also a friend of Silver. And so the idea was that Bourne, who was really good one-on-one, would go from legislator to legislator and give them a stack of cash, in exchange for which he'd get a little slip of paper, a pledge to support Senator Mitchell when the election came up. Jonathan would give them the cash, take that slip, bring it back, and give it to the railroad, which would lock it in a safe to use as blackmail if there was ever, you know, if the senators and representatives reneged. That was the plan. Once Mitchell was reappointed, he had agreed that he would compensate Bourne for his efforts on his behalf by pulling in, you know, whatever markers that were necessary to get Jonathan made speaker. The arrangements Bourne was making were pretty straightforward. I kind of went in that. And this thing was standard operating procedure in the Gilded Age, not just in Oregon either. Okay, so this has kind of gotten a little complicated, so I'm just going to review it real quick. The full plan, Larry and Billy and the other frontline operators were going to stuff boxes full of votes for Jonathan and his friends and Brian, which would leave Jonathan in an excellent position to be named Speaker of the House, which with the help of Mitchell. The first order of business when the session convened would be to nominate Mitchell to the Senate. Now, at this time, the senators were appointed by the state legislature, not elected by the people. That would change very soon, and it would change that the change would come from a highly unexpected quarter. But at this time, this was it. All you had to do was get the representatives and the senators, and you were in. Everybody was going to be happy. After that, Mitchell would arrange to get Bourne the speakership, and it was win-win-win. Except, of course, for the legal voters of Oregon who thought they were the ones actually making these decisions. The plan, well, it mostly worked. Brian was not elected because it turned out that the other side knew how to stuff ballot boxes, too. The leader of the opposition was Henry Corbett, and he hired more repeaters who stuffed ballot boxes not only in Portland, but also up and down the valley and up the gorge as well. But the rest of the plan looked good, and the legislators' votes for Mitchell were all bought and paid for. All that was left was the formality of voting, which would be handled on the first day of the session, and after that, Bourne's dream of the speakership would become a reality. But then he started hearing these rumors. The rumors were that Mitchell was planning a double cross that as soon as he was safely seated, he was going to ditch the silver cause and throw in his lot with the gold crowd, and then he would go ahead and pull the necessary strings to get Jonathan the speakership, because, you know, a deal was a deal. But that Mitchell was known even then as somewhat of a mercenary fellow, and he surely thought that that would be okay with Bourne. You know, that what was important to Bourne was getting to be speaker, and that, you know, the silver thing was nice, but he surely didn't realize what a deal breaker it was going to be. He was very wrong. As soon as he heard this, Bourne went out and found Mitchell and asked him about it straight out, and Mitchell made the mistake of admitting it. So here I'm going to read you Bourne's actual recollections of this conversation. "I looked him straight in the face and said, 'You are not going to be elected by this legislative body that meets next January.' The senator replied, 'Jonathan, you can't stop me. You took the pledges from the men who were candidates when you gave them the money. You took those pledges to the Southern Pacific Railroad, which put up the $225,000 that you distributed among the candidates for the legislature. Those pledges have been signed. They are locked up in the Southern Pacific Railroad safe. You can't help it. I will be elected. I don't know how it is going to be prevented, but you are not going to be elected,' I said." Okay, well, this is going to probably sound weird to some of you guys, at least, but Bourne knew that Mitchell was absolutely dead right about one thing. The minute the legislature got together, Mitchell would be appointed. See, the legislators who took these bribes from Jonathan Bourne considered those pledges they'd signed to be their word of honor as gentlemen. Never mind that they were violating elections laws and they're, you know, betraying their constituents and all that kind of stuff. If they accepted a blatantly illegal payoff and then didn't follow through, you know, nobody would ever trust them again. So, more to the point, nobody would ever bribe them again. So Mitchell was right. When the tally was taken, he would be reelected. But, thinks Jonathan, what if the tally never happens? What if there's nobody there to vote? Well, he already knew what would happen if that happened. The governor would have to appoint the senator. And the governor at the time was William Lord, and William Lord was a friend of Silver. So a few days later, this curious article appears in the Portland Morning Oregonian, and it reads like this. Headline: "Mr. Bourne's Fight. Senator Mitchell will help him be speaker." And here's the text. "The engagement by Mr. Jonathan Bourne of 19 rooms in the Eldridge Block, Salem, as well as the lease of the handsome Keller House on State Street, has created uncommon interest in political circles in this city. It would appear that he is entering upon the fight for the speakership with a degree of ostentation unusual in speakership contests, and it is not easy to see on the surface why quarters so extensive should have been engaged. The real reason, probably, is that the Eldridge Block rooms will be used during the session as supplementary Mitchell headquarters." Now remember, the Oregonian thought Bourne and Mitchell were fast friends and had a rock-solid alliance at this time. In fact, everybody thought that. The only person who knew that was not the case, that Mitchell would not be helping him be speaker, that he no longer even expected to be named speaker, was Mitchell himself. So I like to imagine John Mitchell, who I should mention he was one of the most scurrilous figures in Oregon history, just straight up. I like to imagine him reading this article and wondering, what on earth is that Bourne guy up to? A few days later, though, he learned. Everybody learned. Bourne had reached out across the aisle to an earnest and bookish populist legislator named William Wren, whom you may have heard of. He must have been very surprised indeed to get a phone call from the guy who was probably as close to a political machine boss as Oregon has ever had. The two of them together, though, hatched this audacious plan that would prevent the House of Representatives from actually convening until after that deadline was safely passed, at which time Governor Lord would appoint, guess who? Henry Corbett, the guy who out-ballot stuffed Bourne in the presidential contest, who was now all of a sudden a friend instead of an enemy. So the way it worked was, in the legislature, Wren deployed all the delaying tactics that he could, you know, parliamentary tactics, to prevent the legislation from convening. And meanwhile, Bourne was sending out invitations to a six-week-long drunken party. The real reason why he had engaged all those rooms in the Eldridge Block. And okay, so here's Bourne again describing it. "I hired the best chefs in the state of Oregon, the best chef, sent him to Salem to fix up apartments in the Eldridge Block, things to eat and drink and entertainment. I said to the chef, 'I pay all expenses. I want to take care of all my friends in the lower house who signed pledges with me, the Friends of Silver.'" This party, by the way, cost $80,000 to throw, and that was a lot of money in 1896. 10,000 of it came from his friends in the North End, you know, the people who are contributing votes and cash. Food and drink are pretty self-explanatory, but entertainment, now that seems to have been up for some debate as to what exactly they meant by that. Perhaps the best one explanation of it is the new nicknames that the Eldridge Block acquired as shortly thereafter. One of those was Bourne's Harem, and the other was the Den of Prostitution and Evil. I'm not sure which of those is a more awesome name. But you have to remember, too, these names were being given to this operation by the people who weren't invited to it. So their reaction was a bit crisp. They were on the outside of this $80,000 party looking in. And so perhaps a bit of it was sour grapes. But as I mentioned, the concept of hiring prostitutes on a wholesale basis like this was not a new one for the Oregon legislature at this time. So you never know. So 40 days and 40 nights this party raged on, and the goal was to encourage the Friends of Silver to not show up at the state capitol so that a quorum could not be met. Without a quorum, the legislature could never be convened, and if it wasn't convened, it couldn't send out orders to, you know, like they usually do the state police to go and round up the legislators when they're trying to hold things up. Couldn't do that, I don't think the state police existed at this time, but if it did, they couldn't. And also, in a worst-case scenario, why, you know, everybody would be too drunk to function, too. So, again, no quorum. Eventually, Bourne ran the clock down, and Governor Lord appointed Corbett as planned. Corbett was delighted. He'd wanted to be a senator for years. I believe his father was a senator. But when he arrived, he met a pretty chilly reception. It seemed that the railroad had taken it personally. It had invested $225 perfectly good $1,000 in Mitchell's reelection, and now that money was completely wasted, and they're pulling every string they could get their hands on. So the Senate refused to seat him, and the Senate seat for Oregon remained vacant for 2 years. At the end of that time, Joseph Simon was elected to it, and that was that. Now, you might be thinking, you know, why did the railroad want Mitchell in there so badly? Yeah, they had a lot of money, but, you know, $225,000, you'd probably rather spend it on something else. The thing is, he was a key player in an ongoing scheme to essentially steal state land from the state of Oregon, public land from the state of Oregon. The railroads and the big timber companies at the time were paying Mitchell and some other Pauls to make it possible for them to buy large pieces of land and to trade worthless Eastern Oregon sagebrush for equivalent prime timber in the Coast Range. And, you know, they were doing this through a variety of methods. They'd have these, you know, they'd hire hobos to go in and file homestead claims on stuff, and then they would buy the homestead claims from the hobos and put it all together like that. Mitchell was actually indicted for this in the early 1900s after Teddy Roosevelt came to power. And he died of a dental abscess before he could be tried. But he was guiltier than all get out, and everybody knew it. So thinking about this, Bourne's crafty little scheme actually forced a four-year hiatus in the land grab, or at least something of a slowing down. And maybe if this didn't happen, that maybe Mitchell would have had time to sell it all off. So that's the story of the 40-day drunken party. But there's one other thing that I need to mention, because we can't talk about political awfulness for hours and hours without any relief. What happened after this? There was one more crooked election, and Bourne tried to do it again. This was in 1900, and again he's trying to deny Senator Mitchell his seat. And again, we've got Larry and the others fanning out across Portland, stuffing the ballot boxes. And again, we've got Bourne scrambling all over the Capitol, handing out stacks of cash and taking signed pledges. On the day the legislature was taking its roll call vote, lawmakers got $100 and a slug of whiskey from the cloakroom for every time they voted against Mitchell. There were like multiple ballots. But this time it didn't work. And Bourne, as rich as he was simply drowned in this torrent of dirty money that was flooding into the state from outside interests. Timber outfits in Wisconsin, railroad tycoons in New York, bankers in New York. Mitchell was handily reelected, and an embittered Bourne was kind of left kind of contemplating the system and thinking, you know, something's wrong here. What he did there next is kind of a subject of some controversy. Everybody seems to have a different theory about why Bourne did what he did. Some people feel that he was simply still playing the game. He was like, well, if I can't play, then I'm going to bring the whole house down. And that's probably closer to the truth than some of the other theories that have been proposed. Right-wingers like the Portland Morning Oregonian editor, Harvey Scott, said that he was simply a political freebooter who didn't care about anything but himself. Left-wingers like Lincoln Steffens say he was just simply swindled by William Arend. Most likely, though, getting run over like that was sort of a wake-up call. And I would suggest, and I actually argue in my book, that Bourne kind of grew up there and sort of realized that he was either going to have his fingerprints on the destruction of what had become his home, or he was going to do something about it. And that he decided to do something about it. But then, I'm a Pollyanna. Probably it was just that he was going to take his ball and go home and wreck the stadium because he couldn't play anymore. Who knows? Whatever the reason, he teamed up with Arend, and the two of them became co-creators of the Oregon Initiative and Referendum System. Arend is widely known for his role in this. Bourne is not. Bourne is a little bit, kind of he was a machine politician, really. They also created a system in which Oregon voters, or Oregon citizens, actually voted for senators. It was an advisory vote, but if the people voted for Senator X and the legislature appointed Senator Y, there would obviously be repercussions of that. Well, we gripe a lot about the initiative system, but its impact on state politics was like a flashlight on a bunch of cockroaches. They were still hiding here and there around the halls of Salem, but in the legislative darkness before 1890, or 1900, I guess it would be, 1902, they owned the kitchen. And since then, they've had to kind of settle for owning the cracks behind the dishwasher. And that, at least, is a good thing. So I guess the moral of the story is, no matter how awful the political landscape looks, no matter how corrupt the politicians and how thoroughly bought and paid for everybody is, you just never know. When people get pushed far enough, sometimes things happen. And those things aren't always bad, and sometimes they come from strange places.
Okay, that was my talk on 1890s politics in Portland. And this is, once again, the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition podcast. And if you're listening to it for the first time and would like some more information about it, probably the best thing to do would be to listen to one of the earlier ones where I'm actually doing the podcast. In other words, reading you one of the columns from the newspaper column that I do. You can also go to our website. The central website is at offbeatoregon.com, which includes the complete catalog of about 190 columns going back to 2008, plus links out to the audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes, and to the Facebook page and Twitter feed, in case you'd like to get on the social media networks and talk about this stuff too. Our theme music is a track titled Old Man's Waltz by the Atlas String Band, which is atlasstringband.com. It's written by Carmen Ficarra. If you're coming to Corvallis, I'd like you to drop me a line so we can grab a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com. Or if you do Twitter, @offbeatoregon. Nobody ever takes me up on this, and that's kind of a bummer. But yeah, if you're in Corvallis, let's get together. This podcast is in the Creative Commons. For details of the license, please see offbeatoregon.com/cc. And that's it for today. Our next episode is coming up on Friday, Friday being, of course, tomorrow, and we're going to talk about a frontier character named James Lapius. Fellow owned a saloon, he was an experienced gambler and a gold field blackleg from the gold rush down in California, came up to Portland, opened a saloon and theater, basic gambling, liquor mongering, possibly running a prostitution operation, general all-around bad guy, first Portland chief of police, too. Look for that story after about 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, and in the meantime, go fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.